You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 352 by Rudolf Steiner, 10 discussion lectures with the workmen at the Goetheanum. This is the last one, number 10. It's entitled From Elephants to Einstein, translated by Anna Moyse. Discussion 10 was given on the 27th of February, 1924. It's entitled Einstein's Theory of Relativity, Thinking Divorced from Reality. Good morning, gentlemen. Has anyone thought of something for today? Mr. Birla asked about the theory of relativity and what the situation was today. One read a lot about it, especially earlier. Now it had perhaps been forgotten again. At least one no longer heard so much about it. Rudolf Steiner. Well, you see, the situation with the theory of relativity is a difficult one, and so you'll probably have to pay careful attention today, and in the end you'll still say, even if you did pay good attention, that you do not know it. But it is the same for many people who talk about the theory of relativity today. They talk about it, often praising it as the greatest achievement of our age, but they do not understand it. I'll try and speak of it in as popular a way as possible. As I said, it will be difficult today, but I am sure we'll get back to more interesting things the next time. Einstein's theory refers to the movements of any body. You know that bodies move by changing their position in space. To draw a movement, we say, a body is in a position A and moves to another, which we may call B. So if you see a railway train go past, standing somewhere outside, you will at first be in no doubt but that the train is rushing past you, that it is moving and you are standing still. But doubts may arise quite easily, for the moment, of course, only if you do not give it any more thought. If you are sitting in a railway carriage and are asleep at first, then wake up and look out of the window. A train is going past. You have the distinct feeling that a train is going past. This need not be true, however, for before you went to sleep, your train was stationary. And while you were asleep, your train started to move. You did not notice, being asleep, that your train started to move. And it seems that the other train is moving past. If you take a closer look, you find that the train outside is stationary, but your train is moving. So you are in motion, but believe you are at rest, and the other train is in motion, when in reality it is at rest. You know, it can also happen that you look out of the window and believe yourself to be at rest in the train you are in, and the whole train is going in the opposite direction. That is what the eye perceives. And so you see that the things you say about movement are not always correct. You wake up and form the opinion that the train outside is in motion, but you immediately have to correct yourself. Hey, that is not true. It is standing still, and I am traveling. It has happened that an opinion had to be corrected in this way, on a much larger scale, on one or indeed several occasions in world history. We only need to go back 6 or 7 centuries. People then held the view that the earth stood still in space, with the whole of the starry heavens moving past it. This view was corrected in the 16th century, as you may have heard. Copernicus came along and said, "None of this is true. The sun, the fixed stars, are in fact standing still, and we, with our earth, are flying through space at a tremendous speed. We thought we were at rest on earth, just as the person in the train thought he was at rest and the other train was moving. And we have now corrected this." Copernicus corrected the whole of astronomy, saying it was not true that the stars moved. They stood still, whereas the earth, with the human beings on it, was rushing through space at a vast speed. So you can immediately see that we may not always say right away how things are with movement, whether we ourselves are at rest and a body moving past is truly in motion, or we ourselves are moving and a body we think is rushing past is at rest. I think if you consider this, you'll say to yourselves, yes, it may be necessary to make such a correction for anything we recognize to be movement. But just consider how long it took before the whole of humanity came to make the correction for the movement of the earth. It took thousands of years. When you are sitting in a train, it may perhaps only take seconds before you correct your opinion. It therefore varies how long we take to correct such an opinion. This has made people like Einstein say that we actually cannot know if something we see in motion actually is in motion, or if we are not in some mysterious way in motion as we stand there motionlessly, and the other is in fact motionless. Let us therefore draw the final conclusion from this uncertainty. Well, gentlemen, in that case it might be like this. Let us assume this is a car. You drive the car from Hansi House up to the Goetheanum. But who can say that the car really comes up here? Who can say this with certainty? The car might be completely motionless, only its wheels turning, and the whole of the Goetheanum toward which one is driving might be moving down the hill in the opposite direction. It just needs for something to emerge the way it did for Copernicus in relation to the earth. And there's laughter. Einstein took such things and said, we can never be certain if it is the one body that moves or the other. All we know is that they move relatively to each other, that the distance between them changes. That is the only thing we know. Of course, we know it when we drive to the Goetheanum because we come closer to the Goetheanum, but we cannot know if it comes to us or we go to it. Now, you see, when we speak of being truly at rest or truly in motion, those are absolutes. What then is absolute rest or absolute motion? It would be a state of rest or a movement of which we could say, the body is at rest within the universe, or it moves. But that is an awkward business. For at the time of Copernicus, it was still believed that it was the sun that stood still, and the earth that moved around it. This is true for the earth, but not for the sun. For the sun is moving very fast, rushing through space at a terrific speed relative to an astral cosmos in the constellation of Hercules, and all of us with it, of course. On the one hand, we are orbiting the sun, but as we orbit the sun, we rush through cosmic space with it. We thus cannot say that the sun is absolutely at rest in cosmic space. And because of this, Einstein and others who held the same views said that we simply cannot be certain that anything is absolutely at rest or in absolute motion. We can only say that things are relatively at rest, relatively meaning in relationship to each other. They appear to us to be at rest or in motion. You see, gentlemen, there was an occasion during a course given in Stuttgart where someone thought we anthroposophists do not really know anything worth knowing about the theory of relativity. And being a fanatical adherent of that theory, he wanted to show people that the theory of relativity really has validity. What did he do? He took a box of matches and said, here's a match. I now hold the box so that it does not move, and move the match away from me and toward it. It ignites. Now I make a second experiment. I hold the match so that it does not move and move the box toward me. Again the match ignites. The same thing happens. What has happened is that a flame has been ignited. But the movement I made is not absolute, it is relative. On the one occasion, if that is the box and this the match, I move the match in this direction. And on the other occasion, the box. It does not matter if I want to make a fire, if the box is moving or the match, but only that they move relative to one another. This can be applied to anything in the world. You can say, speaking of the whole world, the situation is that we do not know if one thing moves or another, or one moves more actively and the other less so. All we know is that they move relative to one another, coming closer or going farther apart. That is all we know. And we do not know if one body moves faster or more slowly. Let us assume you are in a fast train, traveling at speed, and a slow train goes past outside. You are looking out the window. You cannot judge what is really going on. For as you travel in your fast train and the slow train comes along, you have the feeling that your fast train is going much more slowly than it did before. Try it. At that moment, you have the feeling that the train is suddenly going much more slowly. Your perception is that the speed is reduced by as much as the speed of the train that is coming the other way. So you get completely the wrong idea about the speed at which your train is traveling. If, on the other hand, a train is traveling next to yours that is going more slowly, you get the feeling that yours is going faster. You can never judge how two movements are relative to each other, but only how the distance between them changes. We may stop at this point and say, this Einstein really was a clever fellow. He has finally realized that you cannot speak of absolute movement in the universe, but only of relative movements. It is clever. And as you will understand, it is true for many things. For no one seeing a star, let us say, at rest, can say it is a star at rest. If you move at a certain rate, the star seems to move in the opposite direction. But it may also be moving toward you. So you cannot say from just looking at it if it is at rest or in motion. It is necessary for us to know this, and knowing this, the whole way of putting things in some of the sciences today really ought to change. Let me give you an example of this. How do we gain knowledge of the stars? You cannot gain knowledge of the stars if you take the view a certain prince once took, who went to an observatory where the astronomer had to show him the observations he was making, of course, him being the ruler of the land. So he let the prince look through the telescope and they observed a star. If you aim a telescope just anywhere, you will not see anything at first. You have to wait a little, and then the star will appear, and finally disappear again on the other side. The prince looked at this, and then he said, "Right, now I can see you know something about the stars. You know where they are and how they move, I see that. But what I fail to understand is how you can know the names of the stars, seeing they are so far away." Such views will not get us far in astronomy, but what happens when we observe the stars? We have a telescope, and the astronomer sits there, seeing his head from above, looks into it, and there is the reticle here, where two threads cross, and one establishes the location of the star. In the past, observers always thought one might say, either the Earth has moved, or one has moved the telescope on, moving the objective. That is the objective or lens system, which is further away. The glass that is nearer to one is called the eyepiece. So far that one sees the star at rest in it. In the old days, people thought the star moved. Today, we have to say that we do not know anything about the resting or moving state of a star. All we can say is that at that moment, the reticle of my telescope coincides with the image of the star. The two coincide. We cannot say more than what is immediately in front of our eyes. We would thus have no certainty about the world as a whole. This has tremendous implications. It is important when we consider the movements not only of heavenly bodies, but also of bodies here on earth. And the consequences drawn by Einstein and others who think like him go a very long way. They said, for instance, that if motion was only relative and not absolute, one could never say anything valid about anything, not about things happening at the same time nor about different times. If I have a watch in Dornach, for instance, and another in Zurich, with the hands in the same position, I am far from certain that it may not be true that my observation is wrong, for they are some distance apart. It is possible that there is no such thing as simultaneity, with things happening at the same time. So you see, enormous consequences were drawn from the matter. And the question is, shall we never be rid of this problem? Is there nothing at all we can say about the things themselves as they are in motion? That is the important question. What is certain is that we cannot say anything about their movements as we look at them. And it is also true in the widest sense that when I drive up to the Gertianum in a car, it may just as well be that the Gertianum is coming to meet me. But there is one thing, gentlemen, that does happen. Even the example of the matchbox which I quoted is not entirely true. For you see, I could have called out to the gentleman, who gave such a fine demonstration, "How about nailing the box to the table, and see how well you can move it then? You'd certainly need a lot of strength to move the whole table to and fro." So, there is something not right somewhere. You can find out what it is if you consider the matter very carefully. Let us assume you go by car from Dornach to Basel. Now we might say it is not true that the car is moving. It is stationary, and only the wheels are moving, and Basel is coming to meet it. Fine. But there is one thing that speaks against it. The car will be worn out after some years, and the fact that the car is worn out can only be due to the fact that it was not the road that moved, but the car, and that it has been worn out, ruined, by what went on inside it. So if you do not only look at the movement, but also inside the body itself to see what effect movement has, then you will realize that Einstein's conclusion does not apply all the way. So you'll find that the car wears itself out, and it is not only that the tires are worn down from going round and round. Now, someone might say, well, they would also go round if the hill were coming toward one, or if Basel comes toward one, or otherwise they would get worn down. And then one might still say, maybe it is like that after all. It is not easy to decide in the case of lifeless bodies. And all you can say in the case of lifeless bodies is that it is uncertain how much the one or the other is moving. But a living organism, imagine you walk to Basel, and someone else stays here in Dornach, standing still for the 2 hours you need to walk to Basel. Now, if you had not moved toward it, but Basel had come to meet you, you would have practically done no more than the other person who remained standing still. But you've grown tired. A change has come over you. This change, which is happening inside you, does tell you that you have moved. And with living bodies, it is possible, in a way, to tell from the change that happens in them if they are truly in motion, or only in apparent motion, and therefore at rest. And that is also what must help us to realize that one must not base theories on observations made in the world, not even something that seems as obvious as movement does. We must base our theory on internal changes. So the situation is that with the theory of relativity, too, we have to say to ourselves, someone who only looks at the outer aspect of things will not get anywhere. You have to consider the inside. And then the theory of relativity actually helps us to make at least a beginning with the science of the spirit, with anthroposophy. For in anthroposophy, we are always asked to consider the inner aspect. Einstein's theory has had some extraordinarily strange consequences. The matter gets particularly interesting, for instance, when Einstein gives examples. One example was his effort to prove that the change in location has no significance at all. He therefore said, if I fling a watch, the hands of which are in a particular position, out into space, so that it goes out at the speed of light, turns round, and comes back again, this movement has had no significance for the inner parts of the watch. The watch comes back unchanged. That was the kind of example Einstein would give. If a body moves or not, we cannot tell. The watch is the same. It is the same to it if it moves or remains at rest. But, gentlemen, one simply has to ask you to look at the reality of a watch flying out into cosmic space at the speed of light and coming back again. You won't see anything of that watch. It will have been pulverized so that you can no longer see it. What does this mean? It means one cannot think like that. It leads to thoughts that are thoughtless. And so you'll find, on one hand, that Einstein is a very clever man, and that he draws conclusions, forms opinions that people find most attractive. You know, ordinary people who are not the best of mathematicians will not understand much of Einstein's theory. And then they begin to read about Einstein's theory in some popular book. They read the first page and give a yawn. They read half the second page and then they stop. And they'll say, "It must be something terribly clever, for if it were not terribly clever, I would be able to understand it." And a lot of people are saying that it is something very clever. That is how public opinion has been formed concerning the theory of relativity. But there are people who do understand it, and Einstein's followers come from among those who do understand it, their numbers growing daily. It is not that it has been forgotten, as Mr. Birla thinks. University professors did not want to know about Einstein's theory if you tried to talk to them about it a few years ago. Today, people in the academic world in particular are full of Einstein's theory. But people do develop strange notions about it. I once had a debate about Einstein's theory with university professors. Now, you see, for as long as one stays in the area, which I have also been discussing here, Einstein's theory of relativity is correct. There's nothing you can do about it. It is like that with railway stations, with solar systems, with movements in the whole world. In that respect, it is quite correct. But the academics then apply it to everything and say, for example, the size of a person is also relative. He does not have absolute, but only relative size. It merely seems to me that he is that tall. He is that tall in relation, well, seeing we are here, to the chairs or to the trees. But one cannot speak of an absolute height. Now, you see, that holds true for as long as we are only dealing with geometry. The moment we stop dealing with geometry and come to life itself, the situation changes, and we are singing a different tune. You see, someone who has no feeling for it can carve a human head that is 100 times the size of your head. He then has a head. But someone who has a feeling for this would never do this, for he knows that the size of the human head is not relative, for it is determined by the whole of cosmic space. The person may be a little taller or shorter, but when someone is a dwarf, that is because of an illness. When someone becomes a giant, that too is due to illness. It is not just relative, for the absolute nature is already apparent. Human sizes do, of course, vary within limits. But in the universe, the human being is destined to have a particular size. So again, we cannot speak of relativity. We can only say that a human being gives himself a particular size because of his relationship to the universe. Only one of the group of professors with whom I had the debate would admit this. The others had their minds twisted to such an extent by the theory of relativity that they said the size of a human being, too, is relative, for that is how we look at it. Now, you know that if you have a painting, it may be large. When you walk away, it gets smaller and smaller according to the law of perspective. The size of the painting, you see, is relative. The relativity theoreticians, therefore, believe that the size of the human being, too, is only the way it is because it is seen against a particular background. But that is nonsense. The size of the human being has a quality of being absolute, and a person cannot be much taller and not much shorter than predetermined. People think all this up because they have no real idea as to what is involved in a process or an object that is somewhere near us on Earth. You will be able to realize from everything I have been saying that if that is the Earth and there is a human being on the Earth, you know he depends not only on the forces of the Earth, but on forces that influence him from beyond the Earth. Our head, for instance, reflects the whole universe. We have spoken of this. If it were of no importance what size a person is, what would have to be then? Let us assume Mr. Birla's head, Mr. Erbsmell's head, and Mr. Miller's head is created out of the universe. Well, gentlemen, if the heads differ in 3 or 4 different ways here, then there would have to be an extra universe for each. But there is only one universe, and it does not grow bigger or smaller for the sake of an individual person, but is always there, always the same. And because of this, human heads must be approximately the same. Only people who do not realize that we all share the same world, which also has spiritual influences, believe it does not matter what size a person's head is and say that it is merely relative. It is not relative, but depends on the absolute size of the universe. So we have to say to ourselves again, it is indeed the case that if one thinks about the theory of relativity in the right way, that one comes to the science of the spirit, and not to materialistic science. And if one looks more closely at the human being, one can see that people who think like Einstein run out of ideas when they come to the sphere of life or of the spirit. You see, as a boy, I was able to take part in the lively debates held on the forces of gravity. Gravity, if a body falls to the ground, you say it has weight. It drops because it has weight. Gravity. But the force of gravity is active throughout the universe. Bodies are attracted to one another. If this is the earth and this the moon, the earth attracts the moon, and the moon does not fly off like this, but moves in an orbit around the earth, because the earth always draws it back to itself, just as it is on the point of flying off. When I was a boy, people were disputing with one another as to what really causes gravity. And there's a picture. Newton, the English physicist of whom I have been telling you before, simply said, "Bodies are mutually attracted." This is not an entirely materialistic view, for you only have to think what it takes for a person to take hold of something and draw it to him, and you can see it needs all kinds of things other than the material. Now, if the earth is to attract the moon, one really cannot speak of a materialistic view at all. Yet in my young days, materialism was flourishing. We might also say it dried people up, making them wither. But we might also say it flourished. And people would say, quote, "That is not true. The earth cannot attract the moon, for it does not have hands to draw it to itself. That is not possible," close quote. Then they said, quote, "The cosmic ether is everywhere," close quote. So what I have been drawing red here is the cosmic ether. It consists of lots of small grains, tiny little grains. And these tiny little grains bump into here and bump into there, but bump more there than they do in the middle. So if you have two bodies, earth and moon, and there is more pushing from outside than from the inside, it is as if they were attracted to each other. The force of attraction, of gravity, was therefore explained as pushing from outside. I cannot describe the painful process I went through to gain insight at that time. I really kept turning the matter over in my mind from my 12th to 18th year. Does the earth attract the moon? Or is the moon pushed toward the earth? For you see, the reasons people gave were mostly not exactly stupid, but clever. And here we already have something of a theory of relativity. One asks oneself, is there something absolute in this, or is it all relative? Perhaps it really does not matter if we say the earth attracts the moon, or the moon is pushed toward the earth. Perhaps the issue cannot be decided. You see, people gave the matter a great deal of thought. And what I really want to say is this. They did at least realize at the time that apart from visible matter, there is also the ether. They needed the ether. For how could one speak of something that was pushing unless it was those grains in the ether? When Einstein first established his theory of relativity, people still believed in the existence of the ether. And Einstein thought of everything he described as relative motion as being in space, and space being filled with ether. Then he realized, quote, "Wow, if motion is merely relative, there is no need for there to be any ether. Nothing needs to pull, nothing to push. All this cannot be decided, and so it may also be that space is empty," close quote. As time went on, there really were two Einsteinian theories. It was, of course, one and the same person. The earlier Einstein described everything in his books as if the whole of cosmic space were filled with ether. Then his theory of relativity made him say space is empty. Only with the theory of relativity, there is no point in saying anything about the ether, for one simply does not know if it is like that. And some of the examples he gives are indeed grotesque. He says, for example, quote, if that is the earth and there is some kind of tree, I climb up the tree, here I slip and fall down, close quote. It is something you probably all know. I certainly had it happen to me quite often as a boy that when I climbed up a tree and lost my grip, I would fall down. And you say, quote, the earth is attracting me. I have weight. This is because of the force of gravity, for otherwise I would have remained hanging in the air. I would be waving my arms and legs about if the earth did not attract me. Close quote. But Einstein thinks you can't say all this, for imagine the following. There you have the earth again, and now I am up there on a tower. But I am not standing in a place where there is open world all around me, for I am in a box, and the box is suspended from above. If I drop off the tower in my box, my relationship to the walls remains the same. I am not aware of being in motion, for the walls come down with me. So now I cannot say if the rope on which my box is suspended is let down from above, and I arrive at the bottom in my box because someone is letting me down, or if I get down there, if the box loses its hold because the earth attracts me. I cannot determine this. I do not know if I am let down or if the earth is attracting me. But the situation with this example chosen by Einstein is just as it is with the example always given in schools. It is explained to the children how a planetary system develops, that at first there is a nebula, and the planets separate out from this misty nebula. The sun remains at the center, and people say it is easy to prove that this is true. Take a little drop of oil floating on water, and in the middle, a piece of card with a pin stuck through it. You put this into the water and begin to rotate it. Tiny droplets then split off from the bigger one, and you have a tiny planetary system. And it must be the same out there. Once there was a nebula. The planets split off, and the sun remained at the center. How could anyone contradict this when they see that drop of fat even today? Well, yes, but one little thing has been overlooked, gentlemen, which is that I have to be there and rotate the pin if I am the teacher showing this to the children. If I do not rotate it, no little planetary system will develop. And so the teacher would have to tell the children that there is a huge teacher out there who once made it turn. Only then would the example be complete. And Einstein, if he were to think in terms of reality, if he ever gets to develop such an idea, would have to assume that someone up there is in charge of the rope. This is equally necessary. Otherwise, you cannot say it does not matter how I come down off the tower, whether someone lets me down or I fall down. There must be someone up there. And giving his example, Einstein would have to immediately remember to say, quote, who is holding the rope, close quote. But he does not, for the materialism of our present age does not permit him to do so. So he thinks up examples that do not relate to reality, that one cannot think, that are impossible to think. And there is something else, too. Imagine a hill, gentlemen. There you have the town Freiburg im Breisgau. I set up a cannon on the hill so that you'll be able to hear it in Offenburg, if you like, when it is fired. If someone notes the time when he heard the bang in Freiburg, and if someone else has heard it in Offenburg, you get a difference in time. The sound needed some time to get from Freiburg to Offenburg. Now, you see, this business has also been made use of for the so-called theory of relativity. For people say, let us assume I am not in Offenburg and hear the bang, but in Freiburg. There I hear it as it happens. I now travel in a train from Freiburg to Offenburg. Moving away from Freiburg, I hear the sound a little later than when it happened. I would hear it still a little later if I were closer to Offenburg, and even more the further I go in that direction. But this will only happen for as long as you travel more slowly than the sound does. If you travel at the same speed as the sound going from Freiburg to Offenburg, what will happen? If you travel at the same speed as the sound, you arrive at Offenburg and it runs away from you, you still do not hear it. If you travel at the same speed, you'll never hear it. You are meant to hear it, but it's gone. Now people will say, wow, that is right. You don't hear the sound anymore when you move at the same speed as the sound. And if you move even faster than the sound, what happens then? If the movement is slower, you hear it later. If it goes at the same speed, you don't hear it at all. If you move faster, you hear it sooner than it happens. And people will say, that is quite natural, it is properly thought out. So if you hear the sound 2 seconds later in Offenburg, moving more slowly than the sound, you do not hear it at all if you move at the same speed as the sound. But if you move faster than the sound, you hear it 2 seconds earlier than the cannon was fired in Freiburg. Now, I'd like to invite you to listen, really listen to the sound before it is produced in Freiburg. Try it to convince yourselves. See if you'll hear it sooner, even if you go ever so fast. The other thing that goes against this is that I would also like to ask you what you'll look like if you move as fast or even faster than sound. What follows from this? It follows that you can think what you like, providing you do not stick to reality. With the theory of relativity, people finally arrive at the idea that you can hear the sound before the cannon is actually fired and there's laughter. It is perfectly possible to think these things, but they cannot actually happen. And you see, that is the difference. People doing scientific work today mainly want to think logically, and Einstein is wonderfully logical in his thinking. But logical is not in itself real. You have to have two qualities in your thinking. In the first place, things certainly have to be logical, but they must also be in accord with reality. You must be able to live in the real world. Then you won't think up a box pulled up and down by a rope. You won't think of a watch flying out into space and back again at the speed of light. Nor will you think of someone moving faster than sound and hearing the sound before the cannon is fired. Many of these ideas presented in books today, gentlemen, are well thought out, but they do not relate to the real world. We are thus able to say that Einstein's theory of relativity is clever and does hold true for some things in the world, but you cannot do anything with it when you look into reality. For the theory of relativity will never tell you why someone gets extremely tired going to Basel, seeing he is unable to say if he is going to Basel or if Basel is coming to meet him. His tiredness would be inexplicable if Basel were coming to meet him, and why I do things with my feet when I walk. I might simply stand still and wait for Basel to come to me. You see, all this shows clearly that it is not enough to think correctly and cleverly. But there has to be something else. We have to accept the reality of life and decide on things in relation to life. This is what I am able to tell you about the theory of relativity. It has attracted a great deal of attention. But as I said, people do not really understand it. Otherwise, they would reflect on these things. We'll meet again next Saturday. And that is the end of the discussion 10. I am going to include the appendix after this, just in case you're ready to shut off the recording. This is the end of the 10 lectures, or 10 discussions Steiner gave. The appendix is by Victor Straka, and it is How the Lectures for the Workers at the Goetheanum Came About. In the summer of 1920, and up to the time of the first course for university students, Doctor of Jurisprudence Roman Buss would occasionally give us, the work people, conducted tours of the Goetheanum to explain it, lectures given during our paid working hours. This gradually came to an end. It may be that Dr. Buss had too much to do, or that his way of speaking was not sufficiently comprehensible for a group that included a number of simple country people, and he felt that there was no real purpose. There were about 30 or 40 of us at the time, and according to the work we did and the training we had, we may be said to have fallen into 3 groups. Number 1, actual building workers, under their foreman, Mr. Schleutermann. A typical member of this group was Mr. Grenicher from Gempen. I last met him a few years ago when he was looking after the heating system in the Schreinerei, the last of the workmen from the first Goetheanum, still to be working at the second Goetheanum. Number 2, the woodwork specialists, cabinet makers, under master cabinet maker, Mr. Littvogel, whom we had given the nickname Limvogel, Limebird. He was a brother-in-law of Mr. Schleutermann's. People I especially remember from this group are cabinet maker Mr. Ebsmail, with his handsome beard, later also his son, who was already livening up his small house in Grellingen with Gertianum forms, and Mr. Sonderegger. 3. The group of other skilled workers, painter Mr. Seefeld, locksmith and boilerman Mr. Günther. When I arrived in 1920, they were the actual boiler house crew. We were then joined by Dr. Kostichev, the lady who sharpened the wood-carving tools, and for a short period, Mr. Gustl Hagmann, trained as a painter to assist me, and from about 1921, Mr. Bollinger, electrician from Basel. People who had a special relationship with this boiler house crew were tinsmith Mr. Dollinger from Rheinach, because of his trade, and bricklayer Mr. Ginger, who often came to ask for insulation tape for his hands burned by concrete mix, and from whom we also needed concrete mix for our dowels. Mr. Dollinger had his plumbing workshop in the northeastern part of the Gertianum ground floor, below the scenery store. Mr. Seefeld's paint store was next to this. Mr. von Heidebrandt, who worked in arts and crafts, was often working in the boiler house at the time. His original intention was to cut the number plates for the seats in the auditorium mechanically. But he later cut them by hand, after all, and made the raised figures on them. He would quite often make jewelry in the boiler house after work, and a pleasant friendship developed that continues to this day, when we meet. But he cannot really be said to have been one of the workers. Mr. Jan Stutten was someone else we, the boiler house crew, especially Mr. Seefeld and Mr. Günther, were friends with, for he wanted to have a brass band. In the evenings, the boiler house would therefore often resound with the music Mr. Günther played on his trombone and Mr. Seefeld on one of his horns. My own efforts to produce a harmonious sequence of sounds on a bass tuba were in vain. During the morning break and at lunchtime, a chessboard would usually be set up in Günther and Seefeld's small room so that they might give each other battle. But my ears would be more violently assailed by disputes over anthroposophical issues between the two, who were long-standing members. How often did I not feel, "But surely they are both saying the same thing?" They would always make their peace again. Now these two are no longer on the physical plane. The building work was directed by Mr. Eisenpreis, the architect. In the architect's office, Mr. Ratzenberger would be making his drawings. The wages office, or financial department, was run by Mr. Binder. All of this was in the glass house, as were the baths, looked after by Miss Stola, in addition to her other work. Before this, Miss Stola, one of my mother's sisters, and others had been engraving the colored glass windows in the glass house. Later on, night watchman Umber's watchdogs were also in the glass house. He had been a confectioner before, and at Christmas would bake Strollen for us, a wonderful cake from Saxony, using his own special recipe. But only if Miss Stola had collected orders for 7 Strollen. He would not bake less. Mrs. Binder was running the canteen at the time. Her son, Mr. Ehrenfried Pfeiffer, who was studying chemistry in Basel, had taken responsibility for setting up the stage lighting, and was my immediate superior. So, that was the human environment at the time, or at least my own subjective impression of it. In August and September 1920, before the course for university students was given, there was tremendous activity in the hut behind Friedwart House. Mr. Willi Storer had taken on the work of organizing the course, under the guidance of Dr. Buss and my mother. And after working hours, also myself, were helping to run off copies of printed materials. Mr. Storer organized a shorthand course in the further education hut, with lessons given daily before work. I recall dear Miss Big Letius saying, quote, "Well, I can write it all right, but not to read it," close quote. Paper was cut in strips on the Gertianum stage to fill the straw palliasses for the guests of the currency hospital, students from countries with weak currencies. The huge curtains were sewn on the stage using an electrical sewing machine. Yes, and after the course for university students, the lectures Dr. Buse was giving to the workers came to an end, and work just went on for a long time. We workers were a very different social stratum compared to the artists, who were busily carving wood or stone, and to the members, who would move around in floating purple garments, asking for the lights to be turned on in the dome, 12,000 candle power, so that they might meditate, and so on. We were supposed to take our number plaques from a board at the boss's every morning and put them back when we left. Some of the workers would look all round to see if it was okay before they would take a breather, and if something went wrong, the bosses would shout at them. Can you understand that things went against the grain among workers, who were also members or younger workers or some who had caught the spirit of the time? Various workers' councils, student councils, etc., had developed in 1918, 1919. I myself, and I think the rest of the boiler house crew too, would keep my dog tag in my pocket. I felt myself responsible for my own work, both in what I did and when I did it. If I was still lying in the sun under an apple tree after the mid-morning or midday break and a boss came walking past, I'd stay where I was. I'd do my work, but in my own time. There was some tension. Did the social impulses of which one heard so much at that threefolding time not apply at the Goetheanum of all places? What purpose was the temple meant to serve? The unusual forms, the paintings of human history in the domes, the strange figures, stars, angels, demons in the glass windows, we were asked to help to build it all. Surely it was also right that we should also understand what those things represented. Such questions were sometimes discussed in the boiler house. Gradually there were seven of us, revolutionary-minded people, Günther, Seyfeld, Bollinger, myself, Dr. Kotzischew, Dollinger, Ebsmail, who said to ourselves, something must be done. One day I went and asked the workers to come to a meeting at the Limbuda. The bosses were not invited. The meeting came to be more stormy than planned, but our wishes began to take form, to have lectures again on the meaning and significance of these new things, getting rid of the dog tags, no more shouting and hitting from the bosses, an apprentice had received a slap in the face. The next morning there was a lot of fuss from the bosses. As usual, rumor had blown things out of proportion. It was said that we had demanded that the bosses be dismissed. The matter was taken to Dr. Steiner. He invited everybody to come to the Schreinerei Hall, let people tell him, asking questions quietly, until gradually it all became clear, and the rumors had been reduced down to our three requests again. He then said we could certainly have question and answer sessions. He himself would be prepared to do this, during working hours, of course. The money for the building had come from donations, but he felt this would be reasonable. He also said the number plaques did not have to be hung on the board any more, and slaps should certainly not be given either. But as to the shouting, we should just hear how he too could sometimes shout like anything, for instance at the Eurythmists, and we should not take it too seriously. They had frequently gone in and out through the windows of their rehearsal room on the ground floor, rather than come past Mr. Kellermüller at the south entrance. And when Dr. Steiner heard of this, he had bars put on the windows, so that it might not happen again that a window was left open at night. Arson was nevertheless committed later on. He then discussed with us which part of the day would be best for our questions or for lectures. At 7 a.m., when work started, people were not yet sufficiently awake. At the end of the working day, they would be too tired, before their midday meal, too hungry. Afterward, not so well able to take things in. The best time, for it would immediately follow a break from work, would be the hour after the mid-morning break. And that is what happened. Every week that Rudolf Steiner was in Dornach, we would have one or occasionally two workers' lectures, all based on questions asked by individuals among us. As a result, the questions came from all kinds of areas, social issues, current topics such as the theory of relativity or rejuvenation treatments, art, religion, history, earth evolution, beekeeping, the guardian angel's warnings against dangers, alcoholism, nutrition, spiritualism, in any order, depending on when someone took heart and put his question. The way they were answered took us through all ages and places in this world. things members would only discuss among themselves in an almost furtive manner, shrouding them in mystery, for instance, the two Jesus children, would be considered freely and openly by Rudolf Steiner when he spoke to us, only few of whom were members at the time. Günther Seefeld Erbsmell, I think. I had become one since, and Bollinger and perhaps also Dollinger and others became members later. And it all made so much sense. We were grateful to Dr. Steiner for the love he showed us and for the wisdom he revealed, opening our eyes. He, in turn, was pleased to hear our questions and that he was able to speak to us. And I knew many occasions when he would take up a subject about which he had spoken to us in the morning in the members' lecture he gave in the evening, the subject being one of current concern. But he also spoke to us in a very special way, clearly, openly, and simply, using examples that were striking, almost rough and ready, but always giving full value to the most profound things, not popularizing them or being didactic. One cannot really describe his way, but readers of the printed lectures may perhaps get some idea of what I mean. He would be very straightforward, speaking as one of us. Maybe one could put it like that. And yet we had an enormous respect for him. Most of us would speak with trepidation and discussions as to who should ask a question, speaking for the others, and which question often went on for days. Perhaps you'd also like to know how it came about that these questions and answers later also came to be recorded in writing, so that it was then possible to publish them. This was due to some ladies who were working behind the stage in the mornings, getting the eurythmy veils ready or the like. For instance, Mrs. Fink, Miss Stolle, Mrs. Mitcher. I do not know who asked Dr. Steiner, but one day he told us that a request had been made by this group of people, asking if it might not be permitted to record these lectures as well. Dr. Steiner's other lectures had been taken down in writing for years, because they offered so many aspects, often quite new ones. And now something quite magnificent happened. Dr. Steiner did not want to make the decision himself, but asked us if we would agree. He felt that the questions we, the workers, brought, and the longing in our hearts, were so much our own affair, offering his answers wholly as a gift to us, that he did not any longer feel they were his property, and a matter for him to decide. And if just one of us had said he would find this embarrassing, Dr. Steiner would certainly have refused permission. We did agree. And he then told the lady who wrote them down to sit behind the curtain so that we would not feel in any way inhibited. Perhaps I may also add something that has been told to me by Dr. Walter Kluss. He said that Dr. Steiner said about these workers' lectures that in them he was at last able to speak scientifically, in quotes, something he found harder to do with the members. And it is in fact true that whilst it can be relatively difficult to relate the contents of the workers' lectures to the early books and lectures without finding contradictions, it is relatively easy to reconcile them with scientific facts. Scientific hypotheses may sound very different, but serious students are usually aware of the borderline between fact and hypothesis. We are thus able to find good material in the workers' lectures when considering borderline problems in the scientific world from the anthroposophical point of view, something which is extremely necessary in view of the rapid pace of change in the fields of physics and chemical technology. Physics and chemistry to be made wholly Christian, that was our teacher's heart's desire. Finally, an anecdote. If I remember rightly, it was told to me by Dr. Lehrs. One day it was necessary to fit yet another meeting into Dr. Steiner's full agenda. Someone is reported to have suggested a time when a workers' lecture was planned, using the words, quote, "After all, it's only a workers' lecture," close quote. Dr. Steiner is said to have replied, quite upset, "Only? Only? The workers' lectures are most important." And that is the end of the book, From Elephants to Einstein, by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Anna Moyse, 10 Discussions with Workers at the Goetheanum, in Dornach between the 7th of January and the 27th of February 1924, with an appendix.